And we return. It is today's Topical Current. Joseph Cooper with you on this Thursday afternoon. Bonnie Berman returns on Monday. Well, today we begin with psychologist and therapist Dr. Janice Webb, and we'll discuss her book, Running on Empty, Overcome Your Childhood Emotional Neglect. She joins us from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hello, Doctor. Welcome.
Hi, Joseph. Thank you.
The title, Running on Empty, what's that mean?
Well, the title is meant to communicate the effects of childhood emotional neglect, which often leaves people with a feeling that something is missing inside of them and in their lives. So that was my attempt to capture that sense.
Well, not considering physical abuse, but I'm sure some of that goes on too, but what's the most common form of emotional neglect, and what if there's both?
Right. Well, it's very interesting because there have been so many great books written for people who experience abuse and childhood mistreatment or even physical neglect in childhood. But when I started to see the effects of childhood emotional neglect, which I'll define in just a second, I started to realize that it doesn't get paid attention to, and there's not really even a language to talk about it, even among mental health professionals. So I think they have very different effects, abuse and childhood emotional neglect. And childhood emotional neglect is so powerful and insidious that the more I saw it, the more I felt very compelled to write this book and give people the opportunity to see it in their own lives and not pass it down to their children.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, that's 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Also email, that's radio@wlrn.org. Tell me, Dr. Webb, does sibling position have any influence on emotional neglect? Or also male versus female kids and some bonding to the father and others to the mother?
I think it can, yes, but I think most parents are well-meaning and love their child, right? Love all their children. So I think that if the parents have the emotional skills to be emotionally attuned to their children, they tend to do it across the board. But there are some parents, like the narcissistic parent, for example, who might just have a special bond with and give that child extra attention, and the others may not get it. But can I just give an example of how emotional neglect happens?
Sure.
I think it helps. It's a little bit vague to talk about. But let's say a 10-year-old boy named Josh comes home from school, and he's feeling really upset because he got in an argument with some friends that day on the playground. And let's say that he's feeling a combination of hurt because his friends ganged up on him, and he's feeling embarrassed because he cried in front of them on the playground, and he's also feeling mortified because he knows he has to go back to school the next day to face his friends. So he comes home from school feeling all of these things, and Josh's loving, well-meaning parents don't notice that he's upset. So they don't say anything to him about it. They don't ask him. They don't say, "Hey, Josh, did something happen at school today?" Now, this happens to every kid, and no parent should feel like they have to catch every emotion that their child has. But if that happens enough over a long enough period of time and over enough different circumstances for a child, that child is receiving a powerful message from the parents, which is basically, "Josh, your feelings are irrelevant." And then take it a step further and actively discourage a child's feelings and, sending the child to his room, for example, which gives an even more powerful message. Don't let us see these feelings. We don't want to know about it. And when a child receives that message enough, children are really smart, and they figure out how to get along and adapt in their environment. So they will push their feelings down and away. And when a child does that, it sets up a certain style of living in the world that will lead to a certain set of challenges as an adult. And this is what the book is about. It's about what happens when you didn't learn how to handle your emotions or be in touch with your emotions or, you know, manage or talk about emotion as a child from your parents. What do you then do as an adult?
You talk about invisible factors in the book, Dr. Webb. What are those?
It is the effect of emotional neglect. It's incredibly invisible. And the reason is because the definition of emotional neglect is a parent's failure to validate or respond enough to a child's emotional needs. So you can see by that definition that it's not something that happens to a child. It's something that fails to happen for a child. So instead of it being an event or something that is visible and memorable, it's the opposite. It's not visible and it's not memorable. And that's why it's so insidious, because people, you know, I've seen so many people in my office that are struggling with all these challenges as an adult, and they look back on their childhood and they say, you know, I had a great childhood. My parents loved me. I had plenty of food. I had a nice house. You know, there wasn't abuse, or even if there was, they've already dealt with the abuse, and yet they're still left feeling this way. And it really is because childhood emotional neglect is just so invisible. It's very hard to perceive it. Even if you're watching it happen, it's hard to see it. So it's very hard as an adult to be able to figure out that it happened.
Well, how do you do that?
Well, for me, as a psychologist, I do it because I do it with people by starting to ask a different kind of question, not what are your memories from childhood, but let's talk about some of the memories that seem a little off or don't seem quite right. But in the book, I have what's called an emotional neglect questionnaire, which I completely made up from my own experience. And one of my goals is to, and I have a plan to do this, to make that a scientific measurement instrument, but I haven't been able to do that yet. But the questionnaire, and also just, you know, if you look at the effects and it seems to apply to you, then it's probably likely that it happened. And then once you realize that it does apply to you, it's much easier to go back and start figuring this stuff out.
Is there a website where people can learn more about you and the book, and perhaps it has the questionnaire on it?
Yes, it's emotionalneglect.com. There's a lot of information on it about emotional neglect.
Some of the instances where this emotional neglect and the ramifications in adults, what does it cause?
Well, I'll try to explain how it works. So let's go back to Josh. He's growing up with his emotions pushed away, right? Because he's received the message that they don't matter, and he just doesn't need them. So he pushes them away, he grows up, he's an adult, and he doesn't really have access to his emotions the way that he should. So this really leads to four main challenges in adulthood. If your emotions are pushed away, you don't really get the opportunity to learn about emotion and how it works. So people who are emotionally neglected in childhood tend to struggle as adults to understand what makes other people tick, and even what makes themselves tick. They can't necessarily anticipate someone's behavior or even sometimes their own behavior. They might feel kind of confused in social situations or uncomfortable in social situations because they don't have that emotional, you know, it's called emotional intelligence now, you know, that how much you know and understand about emotion. And the second effect is just being emotionally connected to other people. And I think this is why, you know, the word empty, the emptiness factor comes in, is that if your emotions are pushed away, there tends to be a quality lacking in your relationships with other people. You can see other people having it, but you don't really have it quite right yourself. So it just makes you feel like there's something wrong with you and that you're different from other people. And the third one is self-knowledge, being able to just know yourself. If your parents are not attending to your feelings as you grow up, they can't really get to know you as a person, because our feelings are such a deeply personal biological part of who we are. And if those are not attended to, a big part of who you are is missed. So if your parents don't really get to know you, you don't really end up knowing yourself the way that you should. And this can lead to all kinds of problems in adulthood, making decisions, making the right life choices for yourself, having compassion for yourself, taking care of yourself in the right ways. All of those things become a challenge.
We're speaking with psychologist and therapist Dr. Janice Webb. Her book is Running on Empty, Overcome Your Childhood Emotional Neglect. Doctor, stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with more. And it's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper with you. And we rejoined psychologist and therapist Dr. Janice Webb. We're talking about her book, Running on Empty. Tell me, Doctor, could you relate this business that I read about in your book that emotionally neglected kids have difficulty finding enjoyment as adults? Is that sort of like people say, well, really nothing makes me happy?
Yeah,
everybody else can be happy, but it doesn't apply to me?
Yeah, I think that comes from a number of different sources. One is if your feelings are cut off, again, it's hard to feel joy. You know, it's hard to push away some feelings. They kind of all end up being pushed away for a lot of people. So it's hard to feel enough of anything, and joy gets included in that category. But also, if you are growing up in a family that's not paying attention to your feelings, then no one's asking you necessarily, or at least they're not asking you enough, you know, what do you like to do? What's fun for you? You know, what do you prefer? And so kids who grow up this way don't really know as adults what they prefer and what they enjoy, and they have a really hard, much harder time identifying that than kids who grow up with that being attended to. So that's really what makes it hard for an emotionally neglected adult to truly enjoy life.
Let's take a quick call or two. We've got Fanny in Fort Lauderdale. Nice old-fashioned name. Hi, Fanny.
Hello. I just wanted to share something because for me this topic is very interesting, especially because I always thought that I always had abuse when I was little. But nobody I even know that I was being abused. And in my culture, I'm Latin, and it was seen as the mother is something that you have to adore. And it hurts me to think that the person that everybody adores, I was so scared, and I could never, not always everything was so negative. And as soon as I realized that that was her who was making my life so different, and as soon as I realized, I point my finger at what it was, I was able to be a successful person. And even though I am emotional about this, I think now I can put boundaries on her, and I can not only help myself, but help my children and help the people that are around me. And it's a very emotional topic for me.
Doctor?
Yes, Fanny, I'm so glad you called.
We didn't have a real good connection, so I didn't hear some of it, but Doctor, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that Fanny was saying that she grew up being abused by her mother, who everyone thought was wonderful, and mm-hmm. that it took it was very hard for her to realize that this person was the cause of her problem.
Sort of the mommy dearest syndrome.
Yeah, and that once she recognized that, her life, she was able to change her life so that she didn't pass this down onto her children. And I think that Fanny is one of those quiet heroes in our life, in our world, who makes a difference by actually facing the most difficult and painful parts of her childhood. And then, you know, she ends up not passing that down and being able to raise her children in a different way. And this is, I mean, that's fantastic. And that's what I'm trying to do with emotional neglect, is to help people, you know, really face it and address it and change it in themselves, because the last thing we want to do is pass this very insidious thing down to our own kids. And that is what happens if we don't face it within ourselves.
Okay, Fanny, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Next up, it's Michael. He's in Palm Beach. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say, like the former caller, I have a lot of empathy for what your guest is talking about. And in my life, it has, it seems like I have to do twice the amount of work that everyone else has to do. And I've had a pretty successful life professionally and personally. I've had a fairly good life, but it's always been a struggle. It's never really been easy. And so that's really all I wanted to say.
Okay, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Doctor?
Well, I think what Michael is saying is it's a little bit vague. I'm not entirely sure why. Is Michael still on the line?
No, he wanted the answer off the air.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll have to make some assumptions about what he's saying. But he's saying he's had to work a lot harder, even though he's been very successful. And I think that, you know, that could be caused by a variety of different things. But if it's emotional neglect, it could be that it's because of all of these challenges that we're talking about. You know, if you don't learn these things growing up, and if you're not emotionally connected growing up, then you really do have to work twice as hard as an adult to figure out, you know, what means what, why people are doing what they do, what you want yourself, how to make decisions, how to take care of yourself. All of those things are twice as hard for people who are emotionally neglected, which is why I think, you know, they look at other people and say, why do they make it look so easy? It's so hard for me. I've heard those words out of the mouths of many lovely, successful, emotionally neglected people.
Kind of a square peg in a round hole.
Yeah, it's a feeling of just not fitting in.
And we'll move along. Next up, it's Pat. He's in, she's in Oakland Park. Pat?
It's she. Hi.
Okay.
Thank you. This is like the best program you ever had. I figured out a long time ago that's what is going on with me, and I've had counseling forever, and it's certainly helped. But Michael was right about you have to work twice as hard because first you have to think of what to do, and then you have to think of what to think, and you have to, like, put an extra step in everything if you've even progressed along where you can do anything. But the reason I was calling was I think it's hereditary because I think both of my parents were raised so that they never were responded to, and they were both in perfectionist families, so it's like you don't know what to say to someone who's dying or when there's a death with a friend. It's the same thing. They didn't know what to say, so they didn't say anything. That's it. I'll listen.
Okay, Pat, thanks.
Well, Pat, that is so interesting because I don't know how you're using the word hereditary, but I'm quite sure it's not genetically hereditary.
Right.
But it does definitely get passed down from one generation to another because parents can't pass down skills to a child that they don't have themselves or an ability that they don't have themselves. So your parents probably didn't have much awareness of emotion, so they were not tuned into you when you were growing up. Then, you know, you grow up not being attuned with, and then when you have your own children, it's very hard to not do the same thing unless you become aware of it and change it. So you bring up a very important point, and I make this over and over in my book, that I absolutely do not want parents to feel blamed for this or to feel guilty, because that's the opposite of what will be helpful. It's not anyone's fault who's a parent. It's only your responsibility once you realize that this has happened or that you might be passing it to your kids, or if you have a question, try to figure that out and fix it. That's your only responsibility. But I'm not blaming parents, because parents are doing the best they can for the most, you know, most parents really are, and it's not their fault.
And we only have a couple of minutes left, but let's go to Marcus. He's in Miami. Hi, Marcus.
Hey, good afternoon. Pat just happened to touch on something that I was just about to ask, but actually my question is more for, I received nurturing as a child, but then in my teenage years, I grew up with a detached, unemotional father. And I've had a conversation with my wife recently where my father is very elderly, but I don't know if in the doctor's experience, is it normal for me or for people like us, if I can group us in that unemotional, if it's normal for us to feel, I don't feel bad, so to speak. I don't know if that's a good word to use. I don't feel the attachment or the obligation to reach out, so to speak. I mean,
to your elderly father?
Or he's elderly, yes. And it was rough.
And then when he's gone, you might regret that.
I've pondered this, and I mean, and I've had conversations with him. I mean, it's been a good 5 or 6 years. I've had conversations. I had the whole, not confrontation, but I've attempted to have this a discussion, not because I don't want to attack my parents because of what Dr. Webb just mentioned. You know, it's not fair for me to point out you're this and this and this because, you know, it's not my place, and I understand their upbringing is not my upbringing. But I always got the feeling that he didn't understand, and I feel that's also my issue, but I was wondering
if I don't think it is your issue, Marcus. I think that your father was probably very unattuned to you. And if you feel like your parent doesn't know you, then how can you feel like your parent loves you? And that really, it's not just that the love is missing. It has a huge effect on your self-esteem, on how you feel about yourself, on how well you know yourself. And I think it really affects a lot of adult parent-child relationships, because if you grow up without that emotional connection and feeling like your parents truly know and accept you, then it is much harder to be there for them, you know, when you don't need them.
Okay, Marcus, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We've just about run out of time. Once again, Dr. Janice Webb, how about the website where people can learn more about you, the book, and also that questionnaire?
It's emotionalneglect.com.
And Dr. Janice Webb's book is Running on Empty, Overcome Your Childhood Emotional Neglect. We'll also have a link to that book on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Thank you very much, Doctor. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
Food and Dining, up next. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman returns Monday. Well, today's segment is certainly in wine columnist Fred Tasker's Power Rally. Gee, take a guess. Joining us now is chef, author, and syndicated columnist Lynn Nagasenheimer, my longtime friend, and she'll take us to France. So what's on the menu today?
Well, this is a very special day, especially for Fred, but for me as well. So, new hot wine topic, blended wines. Now, these are the wines that combine two or three types of grapes. And it may be a kind of a new hot topic here, but the French, and in particular wines from Bordeaux, have been blending wines for centuries. And we'll learn more about these famous wines from our guest, Monique Sayon. She's the co-owner of Chateau Le Seigle. That's in the Saint-Emilion section of Bordeaux. Welcome, Monique.
Bonjour, Linda.
Bonjour. You can definitely tell she's from France. But what's wine without food? Chef Pascal Houdin from Pascal's en Pants here in Coral Gables is here to help us pair food with these exceptional wines. Welcome, Pascal Houdin.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We're very happy for you to be here because you've brought some wonderful food and Monique's brought some wonderful wines. It's our happy day.
Indeed.
Yes, and we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions for our wine and food experts? Call us. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And also email, if you're a little shy, radio@WLRN.org.
And of course, with us is our favorite wine person. That's Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, this is your happy day.
This is indeed my happy day. I want to welcome both of our guests, and I'm looking forward to talking to them.
Great. Well, Monique Seignon, first of all, where exactly is Bordeaux? And for some people may not realize where it is in France.
We are located in the southwest part of France, and Bordeaux has two main regions, right bank with Saint-Emilion, where we are, and left bank with Médoc.
Of course, you are on the right bank. Yes, I just wanted to make that clear. Fred, did you have a question for her?
Yeah, we're talking about the newly hot topic now among wine fans. In California, I know that now more and more wineries are seeking more complex flavors by blending two or more grapes instead of only one. But as Linda said, Bordeaux has been doing this for centuries. Monique, Madame Seignon, why are Bordeaux wines blended?
You know, we blend wines because we want to reach a synergy between some varietals, and also mainly because wine is made to share with food. And this is how we can really get the complexity and have something we can really pair really well with food and share with friends and family.
You know, I kind of compare it to a barbershop quartet in which a tenor sings the melody, a countertenor sings above, and a baritone and a bass sings below, and the result is harmony.
Well, Fred, we're tasting these wines, and let me tell you, that's a wonderful way to put it, mm-hmm. Harmony. What year are we tasting here?
We are tasting the 2007 La Seigue, which is a Saint-Emilion Grand Cru, the blend being majority of Merlot, then Cabernet Franc, and a splash of Cabernet Sauvignon.
Okay, well, let's go to the food, because, as you said, wine and food go together. So, Pascal Houdin, how do you go about pairing a wine with food? I mean, do you drink the wine first and then pair the food with it? Do you make some a dish and then find a wine that goes with it?
Well, I find myself in different situations. Sometimes I have the wine before, then tasting the wine is definitely a plus. It will give you a lot of ideas and the acidity of the wine. Then you want to cut down acidity in food. But I don't have that all the time. Then sometimes I create the dish first. I have an idea what a Bordeaux tenure is, how much acidity is, or maybe a Pinot Noir. You know, I go really strong on the food. And it worked both ways for me.
There are white Bordeaux also, correct?
There are white Bordeaux, this is true. Not in Saint-Emilion, but there are really very good white Bordeaux in the Grave in particular.
Okay, so Pascal Houdin, you brought the food, Madame Seignon. Pascal's brought the food. So Pascal, tell us what we're eating here, because I'm having seconds. It's so good.
What we're eating today is a diversity scallop pan sauté, and it's served with braised beef short ribs.
Ooh.
And served with a truffle sauce.
With a truffle sauce. I want everyone to hear this because
wow, that sounds wonderful.
Oh my God, you just can't believe how good it is. But let's talk about this. So scallops of fish.
Scallop
and
is
we have
fish,
this
definitely.
Wonderful Bordeaux red wine. So what's going on here?
Well, I mean, the braised short ribs go very well with it, but I feel like scallops or lobsters go very well with red wine. It's a density, very firm shellfish or fish.
And Madame Seignon, she's nodding her head again and again. So how do you feel about this?
I feel so great because really our wine La Seigue for me is really about power and elegance. And when I taste these scallops with the ribs and this truffle sauce, this is exactly power and elegance. And we are really talking about synergy between food and wine. This is wonderful.
You know, I tasted the wines, and power is a good word for them. I would also add fruity and very smooth and long finish. Very nice wine.
Well, and you know, I have to say, when you're eating this food, Pascal, when I put, you know, I tasted the braised beef with the scallop together and the sauce all in one go, and then have the wine, and it's just like it's all one. It's just all so goes so well together. Can people order this in your restaurant, Pascal?
Yes, it is. It is on the menus for the past few months, and we have plenty of it.
Okay, so you better keep it on the menu now. Let's spell your winery for people who may not understand. It's Chateau La Seigue. It's L-E-S-S-E-G-U-E, is that?
L-A.
L-A.
S-S-E-G-U-E.
And people can go there and visit, can't they?
Absolutely. By appointment, which is like this, we can't really prepare. We would love really to welcome people who are in love with food and wine.
Oh, my goodness. So this is, so Madame, or Pascal, what makes Bordeaux wine different from other French wines?
Bordeaux wines are really food friendly. This is what the topic of today, but this is really true. Wines of Bordeaux are really some complexity. They are meant to be shared with food. And that's really why probably this is a blend of Merlot, Cabernet Franc, and Cabernet Sauvignon, which really help to really enhance the food we taste with it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how you decided on those three grapes. Other Bordeaux producers use some of those grapes, but they also use different ones. How did you choose the ones you chose?
This is the vineyards which are planted in Saint-Emilion. In our particular vineyard, we have a majority of Merlot. Then we have Cabernet Franc and a little vineyard of Cabernet Sauvignon, which brings the body to the wines that we make
at
Lasseg.
Not much Cabernet Sauvignon in it?
Very little. You know, Cabernet Sauvignon needs sun, so we are very fortunate at Lasseg to have a very beautiful sun exposure. And this helps our little vineyard of Cabernet Sauvignon to really be ripe and add to the complexity of the two other varietals.
Okay. Fred, did you have another question?
Well, I was wondering, something I've never understood is how you go about doing this blending. I've read your materials, and they talk about having, maybe 20 or 30 different lots just of Merlot. So when you go to blend everything, you'd have 100 different lots to blend. How do you use a computer, or do you keep it in your head, or how do you do that?
No, that's a magic made by my husband, Pierre. And it's really about, for him, building the architecture of the wine, just like you blend various things when you do a recipe. For him, it's really about having all the elements to bring a lot of complexity and finesse in the wines. And it is possible because we put separately all the different lots coming not only for varietals, but also from the place for the dirt it comes from, which gives a different flavor.
And
do you keep it all in your head, or does he keep it all in his head, or does he have extensive notes?
Sounds like a trade secret.
I wonder.
He has a big memory and also a little experience. You know, he's been making wine since 45 years, so
that
experience
makes
helps.
The difference, yeah.
Well, but it changes every year, doesn't it? I mean, and that's the art.
And that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of being able to really adapt to the vintage. And that's really what's very important in the ability to be able, that we are able to blend not only varietals, but also the place it comes from. And why it's very nice for us to have each vintage is different.
So if you had a warmer year, you might use more of the Cabernet Sauvignon because it gets riper, or how does that work?
That's it. The goal is to get a wine which is very elegant and complex. So there is not a particular recipe. Just like from Pascal, there's not a recipe, he adapts with the elements he gets. And that's why it's really about art. It's really about blending and about getting the complexity that we want to reach in the particular wine.
So you're trying to keep kind of a consistent style over the years and not vary too much from year to year?
This is what we try. We try to have, but to keep for each vintage his own signature, which is very important. But we try, of course, to have complexity and elegance and pleasure.
So what we're drinking now is 2007. And is that an exceptional year? Is that a year for Bordeaux that we should look for?
It was maybe a little difficult vintage because of the weather was acting. But, you know, we like challenges. And it was really about paying attention to all the work that we did in the vineyard during all the months before harvest.
Do you find that global warming is making it warmer every year now?
Could be, but right now I can tell you it's freezing in Bordeaux right now, so I don't know, sometimes global warming could be global freezing, but it's really about being flexible, and that's the beauty of our job.
Fred knows about freezing because he's in Michigan at the moment.
It's 10 degrees where I'm talking from here.
Whoa. And I understand, did you go out and shovel the snow?
Absolutely.
Good, I'm
Put
glad.
Salt.
Great. Well, we're going to take a short break here. We're talking with Monique Seyon. She's from Chateau Lasseg in Bordeaux. And we're also talking with Pascal Houdin. He's the chef owner of Pascal's en Pants in Coral Gables. We've been tasting his wonderful food with her exceptional wines. And I'm happy, Fred. I have to tell you that.
Short ribs and scallops.
Mm. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Monique Seyon from Chateau Lasseg in Bordeaux, France. and Pascal Houdin, chef owner of Pascal's en Pants here in Coral Gables. And they've been describing blended wines and treating us to some very fine wine from Bordeaux and some very wonderful food from right here, but made by our French chef Pascal. Really great. We'll come back to that in a minute, but it's dinner in minutes time. So what else did I have to make? To make a French dinner. But you're eating a lot today, Joe.
Yes.
Too bad Bonnie's missing out, but she'll be back next week.
You'll be a Francophile.
Okay. Well, today's dinner is one that won't break the calorie or your time bank, even though it's French. It's steak au poivre, which is a steak with a pepper and mushroom sauce with a side dish of garlic, rosemary, potatoes. Now, to make the steak, I used steak tenderloin. You know, anything with loin in it has less saturated fat, so tenderloin. And I pressed cracked black pepper into it. But you could use other steaks like sirloin or flank steak. And then you brown the steak on both sides. And then I removed it to a plate, and I added some chopped shallots. Now, if you didn't want to use shallots, use some sweet onion, some garlic, and some mushrooms, and I sauteed those a couple of minutes. Then I returned the steak to the skillet. I'm getting a yes from both of them, so I'm all right now, guys? Yes?
Sounds good.
Okay, sounds good. I'm all right. All right, and you cook it about 5 minutes. Now, a meat thermometer should read 125 degrees if you want it rare. Our medium rare, 145 degrees. Now, here's the sauce. And as Pascal told me when I tasted his truffle sauce on his braised beef and scallops, that the sauce was so wonderful. And what did you tell me? That the sauce was everything?
I think sauce make the dish.
Make the dish. All right, so the sauce is going to make this dish. So you put some brandy in the pan. So you want to have some brandy there, let it cook down a little bit. And then I remove the steak, and I have a bed of watercress. So you put the steak on the watercress. I add just a little cream, even though this does fit the government guidelines, you're still going to have a little cream. Stir to combine it with the mushrooms and the shallots. And then you spoon this sauce over the steak. It's so easy. Now, the rosemary garlic potatoes are made in just minutes, and I make them in the microwave. So I'm getting an okay from these French people over here.
Why I'm surprised not?
No,
at that.
No,
can
no.
you use a microwave in
yeah,
French
yeah,
cooking?
No, no. Pascal's frowning. Big frown.
You'd be surprised. We have few. We do have few.
You do?
It's like I just say early. So you have to know which button to push.
Right, because he brought the food here from his restaurant and he warmed it in the microwave. And I said, how did you not ruin it in the microwave? He says, you have to watch it.
Yeah.
20 seconds. That was it.
That makes me feel better about my methods of cooking.
Oh, yes? Okay. Well, anyway, you can read this recipe, all the ingredients amounts, and you can see a photo on my website. That's dinnerinminutes.com. And as I mentioned, all of my recipes fit the government nutritional guidelines. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. So, Joe, are you happy today?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Fred, did you make anything to go with us while you're this wine while you're talking to us?
No, I'm just eating pretzels.
Pretzels with her red wine? Oh, no.
Well, I had the wine yesterday, so.
All right. Well, yeah. We're enjoying it today. So Fred, did you have some more questions for our
wine
experts?
Want to get too technical here, but I wanted to give my understanding of how the blending works and see if Madame Seyon is in agreement. In Bordeaux, there are five different grapes that can be used. Cabernet Sauvignon provides the acids and tannins that give power. Merlot adds softness. Cabernet Franc adds deep color and plummy flavors. And Malbec, when it's included, adds color. And Petit Verdot adds fruity blueberry flavors. Would you agree with that, or how do you see it?
I totally agree. And at Château Lasseg, we use the three first Bordeaux varietals you named. And for these particular reasons, each adds a particular element to the final blend.
Now, Bordeaux wines are known for improving with age more than a lot of countries' wines. What do you think is the age potential of your 2007?
At least, I would say 10 years. Now we have all essentially the fruit in this wine. In a few years, 3 to 4 years, we will start to get the bouquet, and this is really where you can start to really enjoy what Saint-Emilion is about.
It really becomes different, doesn't it?
It does, and it gives more nuances. This is what we try to reach in the wine.
Yeah.
Do you... So we should be putting down these wines now and not drinking them at the moment?
You should probably start to see exactly what they will give in a few years. And that's very interesting to follow the life of a wine. Right now, you get the pleasure of the fruit, and then you will get more and more details about these wines. And I think particularly the 2007 gives you right away a big expression.
If we were going to have this wine at Pascal's restaurant, what year would you suggest?
I would probably right now try the 2006, which is a very classic Bordeaux vintage. The 05 is starting just now to give its best. And the 07, you can enjoy it with a dish which we go more with something with more fruit. So you can have the three of them. But right now, I would really go for the 2006.
Madame Seyon, California is starting to copy the Bordeaux method, and they have a Meritage Association that uses the same five grapes in their blends. Have you had a chance to try any of those, and what do you think of them?
Yes, not only we have a chance, we are making them, because we probably know that Pierre is making one in Sonoma with Verite wines.
That's right.
And these wines are really the perfect expression of using the five Bordeaux varietals.
How would you compare them to French Bordeaux's?
It's hard to compare because they have their own signature and identity. However, with Verite, we have three main wines. One which would compare, but I would say only compare, with Pomerol, and this is Lamuse. Then you have another wine called La Joie, who would be comparable with Pauillac, more Médoc. And then you have Le Désir, which is really more into Saint-Émilion.
So these are all Verite wines.
Yes.
Now, let's explain that you and your husband are co-owners of Chateau La Seigue in Saint-Émilion, but you also work with the Jackson Blanqui family in Sonoma?
Yes, with the Jackson family wines.
Right.
Somebody's cell phone going.
Not mine.
That's not mine.
Well, you know we're live.
We're live.
Yeah. I have a question for Pascal. Go ahead, Linda.
No, go ahead, Fred.
Pascal, one of the latest things that everybody talks about is red wine with fish. Are there fish preparations that you make that would go well with Bordeaux?
Yes, we do. I mean, definitely the scallop is one of the leading ones for the moment. But I don't see anything wrong with serving lobster with red wine. Anything with very dense, a fish of very dense flesh, I will do it with serving red wine.
I think a lot of it has to do with what the wine taster likes best, too.
Yes.
Okay, well, this is... I've been enjoying my wine. I've been enjoying the food. And the time's flown by. So, really wonderful, tasty week. Monique Seyon from the Chateau La Seigue. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing this wonderful wine with
Indeed.
Us.
Indeed.
My pleasure.
And you said that people can go on the web and maybe make an appointment to come and see you in
Absolutely.
France.
Absolutely.
What could be worse than that, huh?
Fred can meet us there.
Right.
I'm ready. I'm getting on a plane right now.
Pasco Udan, chef owner of Pascal's en Ponce, thank you for joining us and for sharing this wonderful food with us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you to have me.
And we don't need any appointments to come to you, huh?
No appointments. The door is open.
The door is open. Wow. And we can taste this wonderful wine and wonderful food together there.
Yes, you can.
Okay. All right. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
All right. And Joe, you ate well today.
Indeed.
Well, next week we'll be talking with New Orleans restaurant icons Brennan's from Commander's Palace and Lally Brennan and T. Martin. They'll help us celebrate Super Bowl, New Orleans style. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for listening today. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction by Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and downloads at our new website, WLRN.org. Also a Topical Currents Facebook page, which has discussions, news, photos, and more. Tomorrow at 1, of course, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we return with a special program about the rising incidence of financial fraud in the U.S. Ponzi schemes are just the tip of the iceberg. And today's calendar, on this day in 1862, 151 years ago, the birth of author Edith Wharton in New York City. She was the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for 1920's The Age of Innocence. Also, Ethan Frome, The House of Mirth, The Glimpses of the Moon. And on this day in 1949, 64 years ago, the birth of comic John Belushi in Chicago. Of Albanian descent, he was an original Saturday Night Live cast member. He died from a drug overdose in 1982. Cheeseburger. One more while we ponder the first person proclaimed an honorary citizen of the United States. On this day in 1965, 48 years ago, the death of Sir Winston Churchill at age 90. He succeeded Neville Chamberlain as Prime Minister in 1940. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from Churchill, whose mother was the daughter of the American millionaire Leonard Jerome. Quote, "From now on, ending a sentence with a preposition is something up with which I will not put." Joseph Cooper, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.